Thank you. I'm going to speak in English. Sorry.
Ah, non.
First, thank you to Charles, André, and to the organizers for bringing me here to Lausanne. It's gorgeous, and it's an honor to be here with all of you speaking. I'm going to talk about the situation in the United States. The escaped slave and anti-slavery campaigner said in 1852 that when it comes to hypocrisy, America reigns without rival. Today, in post-civil rights America, we have hypocrisy that would make Frederick Douglass weep. Every year, the American ruling class congratulates itself for black struggles that it tried to crush. People don't know, or too few know, that the US government wiretapped Martin Luther King, blackmailed him, sought to systematically undermine him. But now he has a national holiday. And every school child learns that he dreamt of nonviolent brotherhood. But the radical dreams of people like him and of that movement cannot be spoken. Rosa Parks, the activist who became famous for boycotting segregated buses, received a state funeral, and the president spoke. But few people know that she favored Malcolm X's ideas about self-defense over King's principle of nonviolence. Even fewer know that King and many of the leaders of the civil rights movement harbored anti-capitalist ideas and proposed socialist, or you might say, social democratic reforms and restructuring in the United States in the 1960s. Very few people know this about King or about Bayard Rustin or A. Philip Randolph or any of the people who were leading that movement. They proposed, over 50 years ago, free universal health care. They proposed for every human being in the United States a guaranteed income. They proposed free higher education. Now, from the perspective of those social democratic dreams for America, the state of the United States today is very bad. From the perspective of a struggle against a very specific form of racial segregation in the southern states of the United States, the Jim Crow segregation, we have won a great victory. There are no white and black signs hanging over drinking fountains. And so the United States is very proud of itself and congratulates itself every year for that victory. With the civil rights movement safely in history books, the name of the movement can be invoked by anyone for any reason, even, amazingly, financiers call themselves civil rights activists. Now, we Marxists say that the capitalists use racism to divide the working class. That's true. Today in the United States, they've added to the game because they also have this fake anti-racism that they use to divide the working class. For example, the project of privatizing schools and breaking teachers' unions, they say, is a project of racial justice for black children who have been systematically underserved in underfunded schools for decades. Amazingly, and with no shame, the New York Times published a quote from a banker at Goldman Sachs at a casino, a gambling casino-style fundraiser, raising money for charter schools, which are privately run but take public money, saying that charter schools are, that this privatization project is, in his words, the civil rights movement of my generation. Even slower. Wow.
I know.
Go on.
I will speak slower.
Then back to 60.
Public education in the United States is one of the last universal access, comprehensive public services that is available without paying fees. Public school teachers are the single greatest, the single most unionized, non-uniformed occupation in the country. And that means that teachers, especially black teachers, are under attack in the United States. Black teachers are a very small minority of teachers overall in the United States, but they are concentrated in schools that serve black students. And in every single city in the United States, it is those schools that are the first ones to be closed down and converted to privatized or semi-privatized schools. Overall, in the United States, the public sector is 5 times more unionized than the private sector. Unionized public sector employment is one of the conquests of the civil rights and black power movements. Black workers today are more likely to be in unions than any other racial group in the United States. And black workers are 30% more likely to be working in the public sector than any other group. Therefore, neoliberalism, what we all understand in our various countries as the attack on the public sector, privatization, deregulation, the attack on unions, falls particularly hard in the United States on black workers, and in order to justify the attack, invokes racist ideas. It, part of the ideology of tearing up the public sector is these workers are lazy, overpaid, inefficient, and the image is conjured of a lazy, inefficient, overpaid black worker. Therefore, racism is central to the attack on the public sector in the United States. More than 500,000 public sector jobs have been lost in roughly the last decade. White people in the United States are also losing out. All working people are suffering from what's happening in the United States, but in general, black families are suffering more. From 2005 to 2009, the net worth of white households declined in the United States by 16%. That's a dramatic drop. In the same period, the net worth of black households declined by 53%. For white people, a disaster. For black people, a catastrophe. 2010, the median wealth for white families, the median, was $124,000. For black families, it was $16,000. Now, the public sector cuts alone do not explain it. There's more going on. We also have to appreciate the impact of the 2008 financial crisis on black families, particularly the subprime mortgage aspect of the crisis. Well, once again, it had a disproportionate impact on black families. More than 240,000 black people lost homes that they had owned in that crisis. Why the disproportionate impact? Well, in addition to what we might say about the ideological usefulness of racism, racism in the United States remains highly profitable. Banks made huge profits selling subprime mortgages to black people. And not just to black people, but many to black people in several cities. Take a city like, oh, I don't know, Baltimore. You might have heard Baltimore in the news lately for another reason. The city of Baltimore, in fact, took a bank to court, the Bank of Wells Fargo, for targeting black people for these bad loans. And in the process of taking them to court, it all came out. One staff member said that among the staff, one staff member at Wells Fargo said, we referred to black people as mud people, and we referred to the loans we were giving them as ghetto loans. Ghetto loans for mud people. And the company agreed to pay a $175 million settlement. There is no invisible hand here. We can see the hand. We can see the hand doing its work. And all throughout the 20th century, the hand of government, we can see creating housing segregation in the United States. The U.S. federal government subsidized and underwrote millions of white-only suburban developments after World War II. And on the other hand, we see the hand of finance, seeing an opportunity to exploit people who were desperate for homeownership, and they took advantage of that opportunity. Now, the civil rights movement made a specific form of discrimination illegal. But as the movement receded, discrimination reemerged in other forms. It's a good thing that it's illegal today in the United States to deny a black person a home. It's illegal to deny a black person a job or to refuse them service in a restaurant or prevent a black person from voting. That's illegal. If you do that, you'll get in a lot of trouble. It's illegal to infringe upon the rights of any person, for that matter, for racist reasons in the United States. And by the way, the U.S. is very proud of that. However, there is a category of people that you can legally discriminate against in the United States. It is legal to deny them housing. It is legal to deny them a job. It is legal to deny them the right to vote. These people are known as felons. People with felony convictions can be denied these rights legally. And guess who gets felony convictions? The land of the free. That's the United States, in case you don't know. Sorry, was that a joke?
Marginal.
Sorry, Charles. The land of the free, I'll say it again, has more human beings in cages than any other society in the history of the world. 2.3 million people, humans, in cages. 1 million of them are black. And it's not just the time in the cage. It's the invisible cage when you get out. It's the second-class citizenship and being legally discriminated against in so many facets of life. In fact, more black men, one way or another, are under the supervision of the criminal justice system than were slaves in 1850. We have a thing in the United States called the war on drugs. It's not working. People still use drugs. But the war on drugs is working in another sense, in that it has given a reason, nonviolent, consensual drug activity, a reason to put a huge number of people, to drop them into a legal black hole from which it is nearly impossible to ever escape. Predominantly people of color. Less than two decades after the war on drugs has been declared, something like 1 in 7 black men in the United States has lost the right to vote. Why did the United States government, why is it spending these record sums to imprison so many people for nonviolent activity? Why the war on drugs? Why what many call the new Jim Crow in this form? I would argue that this turn towards mass incarceration solved many problems for the American ruling class at once. It faced a political and social crisis in the 1960s and 70s to which mass incarceration was increasingly seen as the solution. Think about it this way. Who was the most consistently militant section of the labor unions in the 60s and 70s? Who led the wildcat strikes in the auto factories in Detroit? Who led the wildcat strikes in the post office? In Vietnam, you may or may not know that U.S. soldiers increasingly refused orders and rebelled from within the American military. Who led that? Think about what happened on American college campuses, many of which were shut down in this period due to massive student struggles. Who led these student struggles? In many cases, the answer is clear. It was black people in the United States who were at the vanguard, the leading edge of a tremendous moment of social upheaval and rebellion in that period. Black people were fighting back and winning. And white people wanted to do the same in many cases. The new Jim Crow, mass incarceration, I believe, was a way to reverse that trend. It terrorized the black population, and importantly, black people are only 14%, 13% of the American population, tiny percent of the population, but importantly, to hurt the credibility of black people in the eyes of everyone else. Rather than seen as political leaders, increasingly black people equated and associated with crime and criminality and violence. The political dynamic, that rebellious dynamic, had to be turned around if the gains of the 60s and 70s were going to be turned around in the United States. And the gains were turned around. They were turned around. During the presidency of Bill Clinton, excuse me, for example, the national budget for public housing was cut by $17 billion. And the budget for federal prisons was increased by $19 billion. So something that was, for us, a service, a form of housing, was replaced in a sense with another form of housing, but something that was clearly, for them, part of their repressive apparatus. This is part of the pattern in American cities. As public services are closed, hospitals are closed, public services recede. Increasingly, the public service that people interact with the most is the criminal justice system, is the police. And the result is violence and killing on a shocking scale, which I know Kianga will talk about. Black people in the United States today are killed on the street, in their cars, in their homes, with their hands up, lying face down on the ground, with their hands cuffed, in police cars, in police stations. Wherever you are, or whatever you are doing, black people can be killed by the police in the US for any reason, at any time. Systematic racist police murder is provoking a new generation to take to the streets in huge numbers. A new generation of young people in the US, and by the way, not just young black people, are looking, and not just young people, but people, are looking to the legacy of the black radical tradition for ideas about how to fight back. A specter, you might say, is haunting the US ruling class. It is the specter of black rebellion, which ever since Africans were first kidnapped to build democracy in the New World, that rebellion has consistently exposed American hypocrisy. Furthermore, as Ahmed said, the black movement, historically and today, carries with it the danger, and from our perspective, the promise, of spreading into a general movement against inequality and injustice. A new black rebellion is forming right now in the belly of the beast. And that is a very, very good thing. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup, Brian. Et je présente Kianga Yamatate.
Thank you. I'm just going to pick up where Brian left off. For the second time in 9 months, the U.S. has been rocked by an uprising of young African Americans in response to a police murder of a young black man. Last August, rebellion in Ferguson, Missouri, brought the world's attention to the overlapping crisis of policing and racism in the U.S. But where Ferguson brought police racism to the forefront of American politics, the Baltimore Rebellion transformed this general awareness into a full-blown political crisis. Ferguson, Missouri, is a small suburb of the American city of St. Louis with a population of only 20,000 people. It's a mostly African-American suburb that was being brutally governed by a white political machine. Even though Ferguson was 67% black, 50 of the 53 police in town were white. The mayor and all but one councilman on the city council were white. In this way, the confrontation in Ferguson more closely resembled the racial dynamics of the Jim Crow South, than that which is experienced by most African Americans living in major American cities. This is what has made the Baltimore uprising potentially more dangerous than the struggle in Ferguson. Baltimore is not a small or marginal suburban community that can easily be dismissed as a city that simply had not caught up with modern times. Instead, it's the 26th largest city in the U.S. with a population over 600,000 and a city that is 63% African American. Unlike in Ferguson, black elected officials control the political apparatus in Baltimore. The mayor is black, the police chief is black, and so is half of the police force. The superintendent of police or of public schools in Baltimore is black, and more than half of the city council, including its president, is African American. This is critical to understanding the political crisis prompted by the Baltimore uprising in particular. In Ferguson, a central part of the political discussion and a focus of local activists became increasing the number of black representatives in public office, including the recruitment of more black police and more blacks on the local city council. But Baltimore dramatically demonstrates the stark limitations of such a strategy, and in doing so, it exposes the lie of the United States as colorblind or post-racial. It undermines the U.S.'s continued claim to be the leader of the free world. As the U.S. continues to assert its authority internationally, the spectacle of white police officers murdering and abusing black men, women, and children hangs thick in the air. It exposes the hypocrisy of Obama when he speaks about American democracy, as he did last September when explaining the new American war on the Islamic State. He said then, quote, "America, our endless blessings bestow an enduring burden. But as Americans, we welcome our responsibility to lead. From Europe to Asia, from the far reaches of Africa to war-torn capitals of the Middle East, we stand for freedom, for justice, for dignity. These are the values that have guided our nation since its founding." These comments did not fit reality then, but today they are completely absurd. The U.S. has not an ounce of credibility when it comes to any discussion about freedom, justice, or dignity. This today is what makes this crisis of policing and racism a central phenomenon in American politics. It obliterates the American ruling class's conception of itself, including the primacy of American democracy. Baltimore is some 40 miles away from the nation's capital, thereby thrusting the politics of the rebellion right into the center of American politics. And it is a crisis unlikely to end anytime soon. There have not been multiple uprisings in American cities within months of each other since the rebellions of the 1960s. As important as these rebellions have been over the last 9 months, it's been the emergence of the black movement against racism and policing that is perhaps the most important development in that time. The movement has been referred to as Black Lives Matter after a hashtag that was created during the protest that erupted after the acquittal of George Zimmerman, the vigilante that murdered unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin in February of 2012. The movement has continued to build momentum for the simple reason that the police continue to kill African Americans with little to no punishment at all. All over the United States, young working class black people have marched, protested, and rebelled against the unchecked police violence, harassment, and murder that pervades the neighborhoods that black people live in. To say that black communities exist under police occupation in police state-like conditions is not an exaggeration. It is basic facts. Consider this. On March 2nd of this year, President Barack Obama's task force on 21st century policing delivered their findings after 90 days of investigation. This commission had been organized in the heat of the first national waves of protests last December. Obama hastily organized the committee to create the appearance that the federal government was being responsive to the demands of popular protest and as a way to get demonstrators off the streets. He met with youth activists and even put some of them on the committee itself to give it an air of legitimacy. After 3 months, the commission returned with its findings. The contents don't really matter. There were a number of findings in the report, some useful, some not particularly useful. One could say many things about it. There were 58 recommendations the commission made in terms of reforming American policing. But what perhaps is more telling, more than anything discovered in the task force report, is that 29 days after its release, 111 more people had been killed by law enforcement in the United States. The 111 people killed in March were 33 more people than killed by law enforcement in February. By the end of April, before the rebellion in Baltimore, from January to mid-April, 381 people had already been killed by police in the United States. And this is only the tip of the iceberg. The Guardian newspaper ran a story earlier this year on the inconsistent way the federal government tracks the number of people killed annually by the police. That's a generous way of saying that while the American government can tell you how many children die of the flu each week, and they can tell you how many eggs a hen lays each month, and they can even tell you what percentage of white men over the age of 20 consume nuts as snacks, they cannot tell you how many people are killed at the hands of law enforcement in a given week, month, or year. And they can't tell you the race or ethnicity of those who were killed by law enforcement either. And when you look at the numbers that have been called together, you understand why. According to the findings of a study conducted by the Bureau of Justice Statistics on police homicides, in the years 2003 through 2009, in 2011, so not including 2010, American police killed 7,427 people. That is an average of 928 people a year. Consider that 58 American soldiers were killed in Iraq last year, or that 78 people were killed by law enforcement in Canada in 2014, or that from 2010 to 2014, police in England killed 4 people. In Germany, the police killed no one in 2013 and 2014. In China, with a population 4.5 times the size of the United States, the police killed 12 people in 2014. And this is only a fraction of what we know. There are 18,000 police departments in the United States, and only 1,000 of them bother to report to the federal government how many people they kill each year. The New York City Police Department, for example, has not reported on how many civilians it has killed since 2007. The state of Florida does not report at all. So we have a very limited view of the extent of police homicide in the U.S., and because of the lack of consistent tracking, we have no idea what proportion of these deaths are incurred by African Americans or Latinos. But we do know that African Americans endure disproportionate encounters with the police, and thus we can assume that the vast majority of the almost 7,500 people killed by the police in this time period are black or brown. If this were happening in any other country, it would be called what it is: an abject abuse of any notion of human or civil rights, bearing all of the markings of an authoritarian police state, where murder and mayhem at the hands of the state is boiled down to the cost of doing business. And the cost of doing business is quite high. In the city of Chicago alone, the city has spent $500 million over the last 10 years to settle or pay out lawsuits against the city for police brutality and wrongful death cases. The New York Police Department has averaged $100 million settlements for police brutality and wrongful death lawsuits a year over the last decade, adding up to $1 billion. Any other public institution that incurred this kind of expense or deficit has its budget and services shrank, or the institution itself is shut down. When the Chicago Board of Education claimed it was running a billion-dollar deficit, they simply closed 52 public schools and never looked back. But the police in the United States have been an untouchable institution. In many ways, it's one of the last fully functioning public institutions because of its indispensable role in policing the consequences of economic, social, and racial inequality in the neighborhoods of poor and working class blacks. The rebellions and movements against police terrorism in the U.S. has done more than just amplify the degree of violence that the American state invokes to maintain order in its city. In doing so, it has also uncovered the anemic underbelly of the American economic recovery and the dramatic ways that black people have been excluded from the new bounty. For example, the section of Baltimore where Freddie Gray was pursued, picked up, and eventually murdered by the police is one of the poorest in the entire city. 21% of people in Freddie Gray's neighborhood are unemployed. 25% of the buildings are abandoned and in a state of disrepair. The life expectancy is 6 years shorter than in the rest of the city of Baltimore. 55% of families live on less than $25,000 a year. 30% of families officially live in poverty. And the infant mortality rate is twice the rate as the entire city. The poverty and inequality is experienced in the Sandtown neighborhood of Baltimore is indicative of urban and suburban life for millions of African Americans who have been relegated to low-wage, precarious labor. Walmart has replaced the U.S. Postal Service as the largest employer of African Americans in the U.S. And so while Obama likes to tout the recovery of the U.S. economy, for most African Americans, it has hardly been felt at all. Black unemployment remains at 11%, compared to white unemployment that has gone down to 5%. Black poverty nationally is at 30%. 33% of all black children live in poverty in the U.S., but 55% of black children under the age of 5 live in poverty. And perhaps the most telling indicator of the extreme racism of American society and the social consequences it produces can be measured by the fact that the suicide rate of black children aged 5 to 11 has doubled in the last 20 years, while for white children, it is almost statistically imperceptible. In other words, by every measure, African Americans have a lower quality of life than whites in the United States. This is the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow in the North and South that historically have worked to confine blacks to the poorest neighborhoods in the worst housing, with the worst schools, and the lowest paying jobs. That history of intentional racial discrimination continues to shape black life in the contemporary period, where anti-black racism is no longer legal or socially acceptable. Even as racism is no longer allowable by law in the U.S., it still very much governs access to good jobs and the resources necessary to raise one's standard of living. The greater levels of poverty and what is inferred about black communities as a result, that blacks are lazy, irresponsible, and living off of welfare, sets the conditions for black neighborhoods to experience more surveillance and scrutiny by law enforcement. This, combined with the decades-old war on drugs that Brian described, And the strategy of imprisoning hundreds of thousands of young black and brown men and women as a way to curb potential social unrest while simultaneously whipping up anti-black racism explains how black communities are stigmatized and racialized in the U.S. The phenomenon continues today and is exacerbated by the neoliberal turn in American policing. Not only are police called upon to maintain law and order, but also increasingly, the police in the U.S. are responsible for arrests and citations as an important source of municipal revenue. There has been a reluctance to raise revenue through taxation of the rich, so instead, fees as a percentage of state and local revenue have increased over the last several years. In Ferguson, Missouri, we came to learn that part of the antagonism between the police force and the local population was that the town was relying on fees and fines as the second leading source of income for the city to function. In Ferguson, there were, on average, 3 summons per household, adding up to hundreds of dollars in fees paid by working class families. This amounts to shifting the tax burden from those with higher incomes and the greater potential to pay to working class people with less capacity to pay. Not only is the disproportionate burden shifted to the poor and working class, but when these fees are not paid, they can create a legal odyssey from which it can be difficult, if not impossible, for ordinary people to emerge with their finances intact. When the New York City Police Department went on a work slowdown because the mayor tepidly criticized police after Eric Garner was choked to death in video over the summer, the slowdown revealed the extent to which the city of New York depends on the police not only to protect private property, but to expropriate money and property from ordinary citizens through a vast system of fines and citations. In 2014, the New York City government relied on $10 million a week brought in on parking citations alone based on handing out roughly 16,000 tickets. The city makes almost $1 billion a year in court, criminal, and administrative fines beyond the tickets for what police refer to as quality of life offenses. So that's like public urination and breaches of the peace. These, of course, create incentives for the police to target people and entire neighborhoods for sources of income for the city. And encounters with the police of this nature, of course, then envelop people into the criminal justice system, thereby making it even harder to get a job or maintain any level of economic stability. For example, in the United States, studies have shown that white men with no criminal record are more likely to be called back for jobs than black men, white men with a criminal record are more likely to be called back for jobs than black men with no criminal record at all. So a black man with a criminal record will find it almost impossible to find work. This is the context within which this new movement has erupted. The fact that this has happened in the midst of a political period that has seen the greatest concentration of black political power ever exposes the class and racial dynamics of this crisis in the United States. Today, there is a black president, black attorney general, not to mention the thousands of black elected officials in cities and states around the country. There are 43 black members of Congress, the highest number in American history. It's clear that a layer of blacks have been fully absorbed and integrated into American capitalism, and they, like the president, can be the most vociferous when denouncing poor and working class African Americans. Black Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, she's the mayor of Baltimore, at one point the month prior to the rebellion in Baltimore, said the following, quote, "Too many of us in the black community have become complacent about black-on-black crime. While many of us are willing to march and protest and become active in the face of police misconduct, Many of us turn a blind eye when it's us killing us. Of course, she and Obama both referred to young African Americans in the rebellion as thugs and criminals, two words that were never used by the white officials of Ferguson. In other words, often black elected officials helped to narrate the experience of African Americans in ways that white elected officials could never get away with, by blaming blacks through rhetoric that emphasizes culture and morality and irresponsibility as the source of black inequality, as opposed to racism and capitalism. This deepening chasm between the black elite and the black working class has made the question of class solidarity in the movement an important one. Historically, the black movement has always been organized across class lines because of the all-encompassing nature of American racism. But as more black elected officials are governing the cities and suburbs where black workers live, it has created a deeper antagonism that frays the notion of solidarity between all blacks. When the black mayor of Baltimore mobilizes the military to occupy black neighborhoods in the midst of rebellion, while allowing whites to come and go freely and ignore an imposed martial law for the black neighborhoods, the idea that we are all on the same side and in the same struggle is blown up. But the silence of the official labor movement and the continuing racial divide in American society over perceptions of police do not present white workers as a natural ally to blacks in the struggle against the police. Of course, some of this is changing because of the movement. Today, compared to a year ago, attitudes across the board regarding police in the U.S. are changing. Last year, after the Ferguson uprising, 58% of whites said race had no impact on policing, compared to 20% of blacks who said that. Today, 53% of whites think race has no impact. In January of this year, 56% of whites believed the reported cases of police brutality were isolated incidents. Today, only 36% believe them to be isolated incidents. These numbers are a long way from where they should be, but they show that the regular reporting on police violence that is a result of the movement activism has the potential to further erode white working class attitudes concerning racism and policing. In order for that to happen and to continue to have an effect, the movement has to grow. It has to go beyond black people who are the most affected. It has to draw in other parts of the working class that are also suffering under police racism and attack, including Latinos, Arabs, Muslims, undocumented workers, and black women and black trans women whose abuse at the hands of police and the state often go unnoticed because of the propensity of violence directed at black men. But we also saw with the mostly white Occupy movement how quickly the state can go from using racism to justify the expansion of its policing powers to then turning those new technologies of policing towards any threat to the political establishment. Occupy represented such a threat and suffered enormous police violence and abuse as a result. There has also been a concerted effort to draw organized labor, which, as Brian explained, has a disproportionately higher level of representation among black workers, into the movement. We can imagine a future of workplace actions against police brutality and murder, but that has to be organized and argued for, especially when the official bodies of the American labor movement remain relatively silent about the problem of racism and police violence. That is the basis upon which a much broader movement against police terrorism can be organized and waged. But this has to be a part of a strategy to do so. This is just one of the roles that the organized left has to play in the coming months. In conclusion, there is a long history of the fight against police violence in black communities. In 1951, a multiracial contingent of activists of the Civil Rights Congress raised the slogan, "We Charge Genocide," to characterize the depth and consequences of police murder and the silent complicity of the state. The preamble of their petition claimed then, in 1951, quote, "There was a time when racist violence had its center in the South. But as the Negro people spread to the north, east, and west, seeking to escape the southern hell, the violence impelled in the first instance by the economic motives followed them, its cause also economic. Once most of the violence against Negroes occurred in the countryside, but that was before the Negro immigrations of the 20s and 30s, the 1920s and 30s. Now there is not a great American city, from New York to Cleveland to Detroit, from Washington, the nation's capital, to Chicago, from Memphis to Atlanta or Birmingham, from New Orleans to Los Angeles, that is not disgraced by the wanton killing of innocent Negroes. It is no longer a sectional phenomenon. Once the classic method of lynching was the rope, now it is the policeman's bullet. To many an American, the police are the government, certainly its most visible representative. We submit that the evidence suggests that the killing of Negroes has become police policy in the United States, and that police policy is the most practical expression of government policy. This August will mark the 50th anniversary of the Watts Rebellion in South Central Los Angeles. In fact, we are in the period of 50th anniversaries of the Black insurgency of the 1960s, when more than 500,000 African Americans rose up against poverty, substandard housing, and police brutality primarily. Out of the ashes of the Watts Rebellion, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense was born in Oakland, California. That self-defense was against police murder and violence. If nothing else, these anniversaries and the We Charge Genocide contingent give some indication of the resiliency of Black struggle against police terrorism, but also the persistence of police violence. It is almost never useful to compare eras. It is even less useful to look at the past and say that nothing has changed. But these anniversaries are the living examples of the continuities between the present and the past, and reminders that in some cases, the past is not yet past. I want to end with a quote from Martin Luther King that I think exemplifies the centrality and importance of the Black struggle in all of American politics. That is as relevant today, the quote is as relevant today, as it was in 1967 when he first wrote this essay in the aftermath of the Detroit Rebellion. The essay wasn't published until 1969 after his death, but it speaks in a very haunting way to the moment that we are in today. And so with this I close. Quote, "I am not sad that Black Americans are rebelling. This was not only inevitable, but eminently desirable. Without this magnificent ferment among Negroes, the old evasions and procrastinations would have continued indefinitely. Black men have slammed the door shut on a past of deadening passivity. Except for the Reconstruction years, they have never in their long history on American soil struggled with such creativity and courage for their freedom. These are our bright years of emergence. Though they are painful ones, they cannot be avoided. In these trying circumstances, the Black Revolution is much more than a struggle for the rights of Negroes. It is forcing America to face all of its interrelated flaws: racism, poverty, militarism, and materialism. It is exposing the evils that are rooted deeply in the whole structure of our society. It reveals systemic rather than superficial flaws and suggests that radical reconstruction of society itself is the real issue to be faced. Today's dissenters tell the complacent majority that the time has come when further evasion of social responsibility in a turbulent world will court disaster and death. America has not yet changed because so many people think it need not change. But this is the illusion of the damned. America must change because 23 million Black citizens will no longer live supinely in a wretched past. They have left the valley of despair. They have found strength in struggle. Joined by white allies, they will shake the prison walls until they fall. America must change. Thank you.